This is The Hollywood Outsider, a weekly movie and TV podcast. A new episode available each week at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or your podcast app of choice. My name is Aaron Peterson, and I'll be your host along with John Davenport.
Hi, guys.
Hey. We're having a special episode of The Hollywood Outsider because, as our loyal listeners know, we like to bring interviews with independent filmmakers kind of to give you an insight into both what goes into getting their films made as well as insight into the respective film itself. Now, this time we are talking to Matt Escandari. Now, Matt is the director of a new film called 12 Feet Deep. What 12 Feet Deep revolves around are two sisters that are basically trapped in a pool. They're trapped in a pool. They're inside an Olympic-sized swimming pool. The cover accidentally gets closed. There is a reason for it, and it actually works. It's not ridiculous, I promise. And they have to basically fight for survival, all while a mysterious woman is maybe keeping them locked in there. John, what did you think of 12 Feet Deep?
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot more than I thought it was going to end up being. I mean, the thing is I kind of went in with low expectations. And you know what? I was surprised by how much I enjoyed just the story these two girls were telling, and the way it was shot and the way they played with claustrophobia in a couple of senses. You know, I thought it was pretty fun.
And tragedy. They play with tragedy quite a bit. That was the one thing. And low expectations, I don't want to make it seem like, well, I thought this is going to be anything else. I mean, the movie is shot well, looks well, the actresses are all strong. But the concept seemed thin when you walk into it. You know, you're trapped in your pool for an hour and a half. I mean, how's that going to play out? But it really works. And a lot of it, due to the way it's shot, the tension involved, and the acting. The acting is very strong, and that carries a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very insightful interview. Matt is a really nice guy to talk to. I really hope you guys support the film. Go check it out. Support his work going forward. And it's got Tobin Bell, Diane Farr, and the primary stars are Nora Jane Noon and Alexander Park. So you guys are going to enjoy it. Give it a shot. But first, or after, whichever way you want to do it. If you want to listen to them, or go, if you want to watch the movie right now, go do that. Then come back and listen to the interview. Or if you want to hear it and then go check out the movie, it's really your call. But either way, check it out. 12 Feet Deep. Right now, without further ado, take a listen to our exclusive interview with director of 12 Feet Deep, Matt Escandari.
Hello.
Hey, is this Matt?
Yes.
Hey, Aaron. Matt. Yes, and I've got, this is Aaron, and I've got my co-host, John Davenport, with us as well.
Hey, Matt, nice to meet you.
Hey, John, nice to meet you guys. Pleasure. Pleasure is all mine.
Oh, thanks for coming on to talk about 12 Feet Deep.
Yeah, I'm excited. Have you guys seen the film yet, or did they send you an advanced screener?
Yes, they did. Yep.
Sweet.
Well, first up, tell us a little about yourself. Like, first thing I ask anybody is, what was the moment? Was there a time or a place or a moment when you knew, yes, I want to be a filmmaker? When was that for you?
I think looking back, there's a couple moments, like key critical moments in my career personally, where you know I made that decision that this was something that I enjoyed doing, or it's just one of those passions that you can't turn it off. You're so obsessed with it, or it just takes over your life. And you realize, okay, maybe I'm decent at this. So it was, you know, I went to USC Film School. So I graduated from there in 2006. I went into the Critical Studies program, which basically means you pay money to watch a lot of movies, basically is what it is.
Yeah, my kind of place.
Yeah, right, exactly. So your parents are usually like, what the hell do you do in class every day? And you're like, oh, I watch movies and write about them. And they're like, are you going to be able to make money doing that? Or that sounds a little crazy. So yeah, when you leave film school, you know, and you're kind of like, okay, what do you do from here? You know, so it's like kind of that transition period. And then I made a few short films back then and they gotten some attention and I was able to use those as sort of calling cards to get the first feature off the ground, which was a low-budget thriller called Victim, and it got picked up by IFC. And it was a cool little movie. It was tough. I remember it was a pain to make. It was a challenge, and it was my first time as a feature director, so it's a learning curve. There's definitely a learning curve. I can see why some directors come out of the park and just nail it on the first movie. And you're just like, holy shit, how'd they do that? They're just super geniuses. Mm-hmm. I just consider myself like a hard guy, like hardworking guy. And I just learn as I go along. But so that first movie opened some doors, was able to do another film called The Gauntlet. That one was picked up by Lionsgate. So it had a decent release. It was pretty cool movie as well. It's more of like an action adventure kind of film.
Mm-hmm.
after I did that one, it was like two features. And then I was like, okay, now I'm going to get people knocking down my door to do a, you know, a bigger movie. It's going to happen. Nothing really opened up that I thought or I was expecting. So I was like, shit, I'm going to have to do like another low budget movie. We got to get something going on because it's been a few years. And I was like, God, I just want to direct another movie. I just want to get my damn, feet wet again, get on set, make something.
Literally.
So literally. Yeah. So I was like, well, you know, what can I do for pretty low budget? And it's like one location. And I've always been a fan of self-contained thrillers, right? Because it's always a challenge to how can you make this work with one location, limited number of actors, keep the tension, keep the intrigue, and visually as a director, filmmaker, keep it interesting. So there's a lot of challenges that type of film poses. So it's like, okay, well, you know, what are some of the classics? You know, Hitchcock's done a few, Barry, Phone Booth. Some of those had like a lot bigger budget than we had, mm-hmm. obviously. But at the same time, I was like, well, there's something intriguing about that idea of just, you know, shooting in one location and focusing in on the characters and seeing what you can pull off. So, you know, so I was like, well, nobody, so it was like, well, what location hadn't been used before? It was like, cause God, I don't want to do another movie set in a house, like a haunted house thing or, mm-hmm. or a cabin or something. Like I didn't want to do some location that's already been done a gazillion times. So I was like, well, what's something that really hasn't been done? And I was like, well, it was funny. It's actually my girlfriend was the one that gave me the idea. She was like, what about a swimming pool? I've never seen like a film set in a swimming pool. And I was like, wait a second. So it was like, I started doing some research and then I found out that there's stories of actually people being trapped in swimming pools. Usually it's like some drunk kids, they get drunk, they actually fall into the swimming pool and the cover, you know, somebody closes the cover and they get stuck and they die because they're drunk and they drown.
Been there.
So
I have been.
Yeah, exactly. So it was like, well, it's kind of interesting. So I kind of got inspired by those stories and the original idea. And then I was like, you know, I started writing with my co-writer. We wrote the script and seemed pretty straightforward. I was like, it's going to be so easy to make. It's like one location, do it for like nothing. Like it's going to be so easy. And then when we actually got on set and when they gave me the green light, when I was finding a producer to make it, they gave me the green light. They're like, cool. So yeah, are you ready to do this for like 500 grand or whatever the budget was? The final budget was like 500 grand. Like, can you do it for that? I'm like, oh yeah, it's easy. It's totally simple. And then I actually started sitting down with the production designer and the DP. And I was like, holy shit, this is a lot harder than I thought it was. Cause being in the water is so much harder than being on land. I mean, it's just 10 times harder in terms of shooting a film and dealing with an actor being in the water and the camera and equipment and lighting. It's 10 times harder than even you think it is. So I was like, oh shit, what did I get myself into? It was like a lot harder than I thought it would be. But we ended up, you know, executing it and it ended up working. We lost a few days for stupid water stuff that would happen. Water would leak into the equipment or the actors were too cold being in the water for too long. So we had to take them out. So there was like logistical challenges that we faced, of course, like any movie, especially a low budget movie, but it ended up working out. I mean, I was pretty happy with how it all kind of came together.
I like how you pulled that story from a couple of different stories. Was there any one in particular that you went after the most, or did you just pull from a whole bunch of different ones and just try to make a monster out of it?
Yeah, it was more of that. It was an amalgamation, basically. It was kind of like, well, this is kind of interesting from here. It's kind of interesting from here. What if we did this? And it was like, oh, okay, cool. That works. And then it was sometimes like initially it was supposed to be an exterior pool, but then I couldn't find a location that had an exterior pool. So I was like, like the location to work. So I was like, well, fuck, I guess we're making it an interior pool then, you know what I mean? So it was one of those things where I was like, okay, well, you take the cards that you're given to as a filmmaker and you make it work the best you can.
I think the interior pool is a much nicer idea, just strictly because it's much more isolated and much more taken away from possible rescue, I guess. So I like that idea so much more, and I enjoyed it because of that tension of them being on their own so much.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I never thought of that. So I love that.
Tell me how you shot the majority, because the majority of it is in a covered pool. So I assume we've got the crew. We're all in swim trunks, and we're all in the pool.
Yeah.
You cover it up, and that's how you shoot the film. Like, how do you shoot a movie completely in a covered film?
Well, we had to break it down. Obviously, the huge chunk of it is in the water. Mm-hmm. So my old, I went to my production designer, and God, I don't want to bash anybody, but he wasn't super experienced. So he was kind of like, yeah, we'll do this, or I'll figure out a way to, because we're shooting at a gigantic pool, and it's like, well, we're not going to have the ability to build a giant, you know, movable piece that covers half the pool. But it was like, well, you know what, build me a 10 by 10 piece of the pool cover, and then we'll move it around depending on how I want my shots, and almost do it like you're in a on a sound stage and you have like a movable wall. Hmm. So it was like, well, let's do it like that. That was the idea. It was like, well, to have this thing and we'll move it around, and it'll be like hung up through like a chain mechanism kind of thing. And he had it all worked out, and I designed all my shots and stuff around that. So I was like, okay, we'll do it. And the idea was most of the crew would be outside of the water. The actors would be in the water with the camera guy and camera operator. So that was kind of the setup. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, though, once we actually started doing it, we realized that it was like a 3-hour thing just to move the stupid pool cover. Oh. It was like a massive endeavor. So I was like, okay, I guess we're stuck in this two corners here. So it was like one of those things where it was like, well, you know, I guess we're going to have to work with what we have. And so I ended up being in the pool a lot more than I anticipated myself, even, because I had to, like, you know, it was like I was sitting in Video Village outside of the pool, and by the time I could get directions to the actors or to the crew, or if I was just like, but they couldn't move Video Village into the water because that wouldn't work. So it was like, well, I guess I'm just gonna have to get in the damn water. So, you know, I put on a wetsuit and I was in the water with the actors, and, you know, in between scenes, I was able to talk to them right there in the water. One of the other challenges that we had was that the body temperatures, I didn't know this, but even if you're in a heated pool, your body temperature will drop. And if you're not moving, if you're just staying in place for a long time, you can actually get hypothermia. Mm-hmm. So we had to constantly take the actors out of the water, put them in the tent, put them back into the pool. So there was a lot of that back and forth, and dealing with that sort of challenge was definitely slowed us down a lot. I mean, I didn't get any of the cool shots that I wanted. But it was like, you know, we got some cool looks, the DP had some great ideas for how to create visual variety in the film. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things I was talking about with a self-contained thriller. It's like, well, how do you create visual variety so that you're not just, you know, looking at the same thing for 90 minutes? And one thing we decided was, well, let's design like lighting setups somewhat. So we had these auxiliary lights that, I don't know if you noticed, but the actress that came in and out of the, torturing them, she would turn off lights on and off. And that was all just like, that was not in the script, but it was one of those things where you're like, okay, once you're visually designing the film, you're like, okay, how do we create visual variety? We'll have these like yellow auxiliary lights that get turned on and off, and then we'll mix it with moonlight. And then sometimes there'll be day with that. And it just creates this kind of variety that wouldn't have been there if it was just, they're stuck under the pool and whatever light is there. So definitely I'm more of the world of, as a filmmaker, it's okay to stylize things, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have to, you're in a location. Well, there's only available light here. We have to shoot with the available light that's here, 'cause that's just the way it is or whatever. I'm more of the school of, well, you know, let's make it look aesthetically how we think will look cool or look interesting or visually fits to the story and the character. So that kind of is how I challenge myself. And, you know, when I'm shooting a film, I don't limit myself to certain criteria like that.
That's pretty cool. I like what you're saying about the visual changes. And one of the things I really noticed is that there seemed to be a lot of visual storytelling where you focus on a needle here, you focus on the burns for a minute without really telling the backstory behind it. I think it gives a strong feeling of exposition with it. Was that a conscious effort of trusting your audience to pick that up, or what was that?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things as a filmmaker that I've personally learned more and more, and I think I'm getting better and better as a filmmaker to do that, is trust the audience. I mean, people, like, it's funny, you're sitting in a room and you're writing a script and you want to explain everything, or you want to make sure that, you know, that every little thing is buttoned down. And if you set something up, make sure you pay it off. Cause a lot of the stuff you learn in screen, when you're, you know, read about screenwriting or storytelling, it's always like everything's there for a purpose. Explain it. If it's set up, pay it off. But as you get better as a filmmaker, you become more aware of the nuances and trusting the audience, letting the audience fill in the blanks. And you really, really appreciate more other filmmakers that do that really well. You know what I mean? You look back at other filmmakers and you're like, oh shit, no wonder I loved that scene in that film, because XYZ let me fill in the blanks, or they showed me something and then the next scene I was like, wait a minute, oh wow, that's what it was. So yeah, it's just one of those things. It's one of those storytelling things that you learn more and more as you grow as a filmmaker and learn to understand. The audience is pretty damn smart. I mean, culturally, as a like, we're very intelligent in terms of our filmmaking kind of, or story. Like, we've been raised culturally on so many different films, and you don't need to spoon feed to the audience. And sometimes it's hard because you'll have different points of view telling you, like, you know, producers or executives, what about this? What about that? What about this? And you have to, you know, the more confidence you develop, the more you can confidently say, like, no, it's fine. Like, we can leave that there. Or if we just show this, like, a little beat here, a little beat there, the audience will get it. So yeah, I think it's one of those things that was definitely consciously in there.
I have a two-part question. One, well, that one's a statement. I was glad to see Alexandra Park in here, because my wife is a big Royals fan. So she watches it show religiously. I liked seeing her have a different kind of role than what she's been playing there. How difficult was it to get the actresses in the right frame of mind, especially because they're bantering with Diane Farr while they're trapped underneath this, and they're really acting with just each other? And Diane Farr, it seems like, is acting with mostly herself. I don't know if she's actually there and they're bantering back and forth.
Well, that's the thing, is like, that's actually a good point. I forgot to mention that we shot all of Diane's stuff first because she was only available for like 4 days. And this is a low budget movie. We don't have time. We couldn't like call in the other actresses to come in and sit in the water for her or anything like that. So it was just Diane going off on, not like to herself, basically. She was playing those scenes to herself, which is even more incredible when you look back. Like, she's just going off and she's losing it against basically nothing. She's playing the scenes like by herself. And then the same thing with the other girls. Once we got them in the water, Diane wasn't there anymore. We had her for like 4 days and that was it. Like, so the girls had to, I played back some of Diane's performances for them though. Like, that's another beauty of, I mean, we take so many little things for granted in the digital age, but I had the editor save a bunch of like the select takes. And then when the two girls showed up, I would show them some of the, when they had a scene that they were supposed to have with Diane, I would show them the scene and they'd be like, oh, okay. They would see kind of how she played it. And then, so when they got into the water, they were able to adjust their performance to kind of make it more authentic. But yeah, I mean, Alex was a super, yeah, I love that you mentioned that it's such a different role than what she normally plays. Cause yeah, when I saw, you know, the Royals, I was like, holy shit, this is so, it's just a different character, right? It's like, yeah, this, it like posh princess and stuff. So yeah, I mean, it was with her, she actually wanted to do something different. She was like, yeah, I love this character. It's not like what I would typically play and whatnot. So give me like, yeah, let's make this more gritty. And she doesn't look, I mean, she's a beautiful girl, but she doesn't look very like she looks fucked up in this, in the sense of like, it's, we're not putting any makeup on her. You know what I mean? Like, none of these, like, we're really going raw for the performances, which is great. I love it. I mean, I hate movies where, one of the actors wakes up in bed and their hair is perfect and they already have makeup on and stuff. I'm just like, ooh, that always takes me out of it. So I made sure to tell them, like, look, you guys are going to be in the water. You're going to look raw and whatever, but hey, that's part of the experience. And that's what makes it look cool and more authentic. And they were game. They were totally game for that.
Yeah, it would be a little weird if they had eyeshadow rolling down their eyes like, right, 4 hours into the pool. Like, what? How do you still have eyeshadow on? It's weird.
Yeah, exactly.
So my experience with Nora, it was my first enjoyment of seeing her on screen was with she was on a show called Jack Taylor on one of the English channels. I loved her in that. Okay. And I know that she's heavily accented, and so and Alexandra is from Australia, so also a heavily accented girl.
Could you guys tell when you're in the film?
No, actually, I was going to say, why are the girls from these other countries better at being American?
Right. Tough question. I don't know. It's like one of those things. You go to these audition, like these casting sessions, and yeah, I mean, the actresses and actors that come in, they're mostly Australians, Irish, British. I kind of feel like it comes down to, maybe it's a cultural thing. Maybe they just take it more seriously in those countries, or they pay the money to like acting. And I don't know, I could be wrong, but I feel like being an actor is like considered a legitimate profession in England, or maybe I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
No, same with right. maybe in Australia too. It's considered more of like a real profession. So people, I guess, take it a little more seriously. Maybe here in America, we're like, oh, you want to be an actor? Oh, you want to be like, you know, Tom Cruise or something? So I don't know if that's what it is. But yeah, that's funny that you guys, so you guys, for sure, you didn't notice the accents at all?
No, I didn't. But I was really invested in the character. So no, I didn't notice.
Yeah, I didn't pick it up either. I was very aware of who Nora is. So I was looking for it too.
Really? That's funny. It's funny. I showed the film to a couple people and they're like, was this supposed to take place in Canada? Because they have like this weird Canadian accent. I'm like, no, but I guess it could take place in Canada. I don't know. It could take place anywhere. So,
all right. So yeah. As far as your actors are concerned, there's Tobin Bell is in the movie, and the way he is used, and I'm not going to spoil anything because I want people to enjoy this. Yeah. The way he's used seemed to be a great way to build tension. Was that the intention, or was it a lucky 100%. Moment?
100%. That was the idea. Was because I'm also a fan of casting against expectations,
mm-hmm.
and Hitchcock did this a lot too. Is he would cast a certain actor or actress, knowing that the audience is gonna flip on the movie or sit in the theater and expect like, oh, look, it's big name actor. Okay, wow, this whole film's gonna be all about this person, and then you're not sure what's gonna go or what direction it's gonna go. Oh, you're expecting this person to be, you know, the villain or the hero, or they're coming back, or maybe they'll do something else. So I love the idea of playing with the audience's expectations with that. It's tricky though. You don't want to mislead too much, particularly in the marketing. So I tried not to overplay certain stuff, but you know, as a filmmaker, you don't have control. You know what I mean? As soon as like the marketing people see like, oh, Tobin Bell's in your movie. You know, it's like,
it's just, do you want to play a game in the pool?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't stick that into the trailer somewhere just to hammer it home that it's, you know, it's Tobin Bell. But it's tricky. Yeah, you want to be able to play with the audience expectations and mislead them, but then not piss them off, you know, where they're like, what the F? You know? So it's tricky. I mean, some people will love, like you said, I don't want to spoil it, but like some people will love it, some people hate it. It is what it is. You just got to make a choice and go with it. And hopefully people like the surprise that happens.
I liked it because I think at one point in the movie, I'm just like, oh, it's not what I thought it was going to be. Okay.
That's perfect. That's perfect. That's a great reaction.
And I was waiting for him to jump out of nowhere all the way up until the very end. I was like, he's going to save them, right? Or he's going to do this, right? What's going to happen? I don't know.
I love that. Oh, I love that. That's what I wanted to hear. That was exactly my intention. So at least if I fucked with one person, then it was all worth it.
Well, there you go, John.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got trolled. Awesome.
You did.
Yeah. Nice. Nice.
I got a follow up because you can't mention Hitchcock twice in this interview. And he's my favorite director of all time. Is he?
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got so much Hitchcock memorabilia. It's actually a little scary. So what is
Do you have the, do you have that Hitchcock watch? I have a Hitchcock watch.
I don't have a watch. I have the board game. Yeah. I want it.
I'm going to have to see if I have an, I'm going to have to send it over for you. Yeah. I have a couple actually. Cause I took a, when I was in college, I took a class at USC and it was called like the Hitchcock class.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the class, his daughter showed up. They gave everyone a watch, like, and it has Hitchcock's silhouette on it. And
you are kidding me.
I'm dead serious. Yeah. And I remember I took multiple of those cause I was like, screw this, man. So I was like asking, do you want your watch? I'll take that. Cause some people take the class and they're not even like film students or anything. And I was like, I'll take your watch. So yeah, I'll have to see if I have a few of those left over. I haven't somewhere, but yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. So you met Pat Hitchcock. Are you an inspiration? Is he a big inspiration for you then?
I think no filmmaker can say that Hitchcock hasn't inspired him just because of his his films have impacted cinema. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like one of those things where whether you want to or not, you're inspired by his work. And yeah, I mean, you look back at any of his films, and what's your favorite Hitchcock film?
Rear Window by a mile.
Really?
Rear Window. So, yeah.
Yeah. I love that one. Vertigo? Like, what do you think of Vertigo? Yeah, I mean, that's top five.
It's definitely in top five. I love Vertigo. There's something about the way that he assembled his shots in Rear Window and the way that he established that kind of tension by really not doing a whole lot. And how it all comes together, how the relationship works, how the paranoia works, how as you watch the movie, you know, it's really like you talked about earlier. Jeffries is kind of a creep in a way, if you really, really pay attention to it. And just how it all played out. It's just a beautiful story.
Oh, it is, definitely. Yeah. That was great. Did you ever see Lifeboat or Rope?
Oh, man. Rope is probably my second. It's Rope and Psycho are neck and neck, because I think Rope is fantastic.
Really?
Yeah. What about you? What's your favorite?
Vertigo is definitely my favorite Hitchcock. I mean, to me, it's just so many layers and so many. I mean, I can watch that, like the score itself. I can just listen to the score on loop forever. Mm-hmm. But it's just so much depth in that film and nuance, and the way that a scene is blocked, just the way he would block certain scenes in that film are just like, what? I never would have thought of something like that. So like, just the level of mastery in that is genius. But yeah, so, and then obviously Rope, a self-contained thriller in a way as well. I mean, so it's the first time. And then Psycho is obviously top five. What else?
Everything.
South Park. Yeah, everything he's done, like North by Northwest. Like, it's just all his films are brilliant in their own way. Everyone's like I can learn something every time I watch one of his films. And talk about trusting the audience's intelligence, or letting the audience fill in the blanks for themselves. That's what it's all about. You know what I mean? It was like, that was his thing. So it was like, I love that.
Oh, and he created the MacGuffin, which is my favorite little tidbit that filmmakers use to this day.
I didn't know.
Yeah, he did. He, and in the 30s, I think, he's the one that popularized the MacGuffin, which is, for people that don't know, a MacGuffin is basically the Pulp Fiction, it's the what's glowing in the box, we don't know. That's the MacGuffin.
Right.
Yeah, it just carries the film, the plot.
Right. Yeah, I love that. You know, I know what a MacGuffin is, but I didn't know that he had actually coined that term or been the first to kind of like popularize it. It's pretty cool.
He's the man. I'm just saying.
He's the man. He is the man.
Going back to 12 Feet Deep, tell me what, now that the movie is out and the reception is out, and we both really enjoyed the film. Like, I thought it was very intense, very taut, very strong film.
Thank you.
How do you feel? What's the reception been for you? I mean, do you feel?
So far, I mean, we've been getting a cool, Joe Blow gave us a pretty cool review, which I was happy about. We've gotten some pretty good responses now. I mean, so I'm pretty happy with how it turned out. I mean, yeah, it's just one of those things. Once you release a film out there, you know, there's nothing else you can do. It's like, okay, some people are going to either respond, dig it. Some people are like, what the fuck? This would never happen in real life. And I'm like, well, Google it, man. It's happened something similar. Like, not exactly this story, because shit, there's no way I would be unable to get the rights for it. I didn't want to deal with that shit. So I just made it up kind of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so yeah, I think, hopefully it'll, some audiences will respond to it, and it'll hopefully develop some sort of like cult following, and people will dig it. And I think the performances, to me, as a filmmaker, that was the strongest performances I've gotten from an actor's in a film before. So that to me is like my proudest thing. I'm like, wow, I watched the film and I'm like, I get a little teary eyed in a moment or two, barely, but still. So I'm like, okay, like, you know, just. Just being able to get those like authentic, truthful performances, and it was a lot of fun, and hopefully audiences will dig.
It's difficult for an independent film to break through. So that's, we're hoping, just people hearing you talk about it and hearing what the movie's about, hopefully that'll help even a little bit, get a few people talking.
It's as hard as you think it is. It's like 10 times harder, because there's just so much more content released now that to break out through all the noise. I mean, I was listening to, you guys saw It Comes at Night, right? I think you guys did a review on it.
I wasn't a fan, but yes.
Oh, you wasn't a fan. I wasn't a huge fan of it. I thought it was well made. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel like, God, when I was looking at what the distributor did for that film in terms of promoting it, they got all these critics together. They drove them in a bus with gas masks on their faces, took them to the middle of the woods, set up a screening for them in the middle of the woods, and then had like the talent show up, the actor show up, and they had a Q&A. And I'm like, they like really went far with it, right? To get like, to kind of I don't know how to like sweeten the deal with the critics, make them really you know, dig it and get into it. And I was like, God, man, these distributors, like the links they'll go to like, you know, to, but you have to do that to be able to get your, you know, to get your film out there and get people to know it and break through the noise. So it's definitely, it's an interesting place we're in now, but I feel like social media and the internet has opened up, democratized indie film in many ways. So that's obviously a positive. I mean, no matter what, if, you know, your film's decent or cool, people will, you know, you can promote it and spread it online. I can literally sit in my computer and, you know, and spread the word on it. So there's definitely that ability to, it just, it all just depends on how people respond. So.
Well, where can people find 12 Feet?
Right now it's on iTunes. It's on Amazon. And it's on Vudu. So any of those platforms, they can search for it, check it out. Yeah, and it's available to watch. It's great.
Definitely check it out.
Check it out.
So what's next for Matt? What are you doing next?
That's a good question. I haven't really solidified anything yet. So the last few months, just getting this thing done, posted, and supervising that. And then I'm writing a few scripts, a couple things I want to do, but it just depends. I mean, I'd love to do like a pure horror film, like a pure scary, like skin crawling kind of like trippy horror film would be fun. Do something like that. So there's like one script I'm working on that's in that world. What else? I was trying to get this 80s Michael Mann-esque kind of like action movie made, but we'll see what happens. It's like you gotta find the right producer and get the right financing together. That'd be fun.
How 80s then, are we talking? We talking Band of the Hand? Are we talking Miami Vice? Which Michael Mann are we talking?
More like Miami Vice. Okay. Miami Vice style, basically. Like a kind of, but like, yeah, like kind of that, or like Heat or something. So that kind of world. Yeah, that's tricky. So we'll see. And then, you know, I'm also a fan of sci-fi as well. Are you guys a sci-fi fan?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I got a couple like time travel kind of things that I'm trying to finish up now. One of them is... let me see if I can pitch the concept, because it's still kind of in development stage, but I'm trying to see if I can make it make any sense. But basically, what if time travel existed, but you couldn't actually travel in time? You can only send messages back to the past. So there's this group, it's set in the present. There's this group of people, they're receiving messages from the future, and they have to do these little things, these little alterations to the present, so that they can prevent a catastrophic event in the future from happening. I don't know if that made any sense at all, but
no,
it's kind of
absolutely.
Okay, cool. So yeah, they're called chasers, and they're trying to chase holes in the timeline and trying to prevent some catastrophic event from happening. But then, of course, there's always twists and turns. They realize that they're actually, what they're doing is leading to that catastrophic event. So they're being fucked with by this company that's kind of making us all up and trippy mind fuck kind of shit, but
I like it.
You can get that.
I like
you
it.
You digging it?
Yeah, it's kind of like it's like frequency, but like a grand scale. So I mean, it's
right. Yeah. Frequency. Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect comparison.
That's good. I like that. That's a cool idea.
Cool. So yeah, that's one that it's on the plate to see if we can develop it or get it out there.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. We're gonna let you go. Best of luck on the release. Sincerely, I think it's a really good film. I hope people find it. 12 Feet Deep. It's available now, and people should check it out. Anything you want to say in closing?
No, just thank you guys. Thank you, Aaron. Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Thanks for looking at the film. You know, it's a little indie micro-budget film, but it's great to have like real fans, real audiences just checking it out and spreading the word on it. So I really appreciate that, guys. And John is a Hitchcock fan, right?
No, Aaron. Aaron's a Hitchcock fan.
Aaron, the Hitchcock. Okay. Email me your address. If I can find that watch, I'm going to send it to you.
Oh, sweet.
Because you probably would appreciate it more than I can. Because, like, you know, if you're like the super collector, I think you'll dig it.
There's a good chance I'll make out with it. I'll be honest with
you. Yeah, seriously.
He's not kidding.
Seriously. No, I'm not kidding.
Nice. All right, man. Appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much.
All right. Hey, take care. Thank you.
Take care, guys. Bye.
All right, that was our interview with director Matt Escandari. Once again, 12 Feet Deep is available. He told you where. Be sure to check it out. John, what'd you think of the interview? This is the first time you've done an interview on Hollywood Outsider, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, this is my very first time. I feel like I finally arrived. I think I feel like a made man right now.
I think made men are mobsters.
Don't we kind of command that kind of respect?
Not even close.
Oh, shit.
Not even close.
All right, well.
Well,
anyhow, it was a good time. I love a lot of what Matt said, and I like how he thinks about how he's going to frame everything, and it really does show in the movie for sure.
Absolutely. He's got a good eye. Once again, thank you for listening to the Hollywood Outsider podcast. We try to bring you interviews with filmmakers in the world of independent cinema when we can. Remember to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. Our normal show has a new episode every single week and is available at thehollywoodoutsider.com. This is Aaron Peterson, and
I'm John Davenport.
Reminding you that the next time you head into the theater, buy popcorn.